From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Nowadays, we think nothing of referring to movies as a Woody Allen, Spike Lee, or Martin Scorsese film, but the director's contribution to a film was not always considered so significant. On today's Fresh Air, we meet critic Andrew Sarris. In 1962, he helped change the way we look at movies by bringing the French auteur theory to the U.S. Also, actor Giancarlo Esposito tells us about playing Left Hand Lacey and Buggin' Out in the Spike Lee films Mo Better Blues and Do the Right Thing. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz reviews the new reissue Mary Martin Sings, Richard Rodgers Plays. And critic Maureen Carrigan says she's not ready for a new Lucy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The UN Security Council is expected to approve a resolution condemning the Iraqi annexation of Kuwait. Linda Fasulo has more from New York.
UN diplomats say the six Arab nations of Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman have requested an emergency meeting of the Security Council. The Security Council will first meet behind closed doors this evening, but a formal vote rejecting Iraq's annexation of Kuwait is expected to follow later tonight. Earlier, Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar told reporters that President Bush's decision to send American troops to help the Saudis was a parallel action with Security Council decisions demanding Iraqi withdrawal and imposing drastic economic and military sanctions against Iraq. For National Public Radio, I'm Linda Fasulo reporting at the United Nations.
Atlantic Richfield Company announced today that it's freezing the wholesale fuel prices for 1 week. The company said it would hold the line on prices for gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. ARCO's the first U.S. company to comply with President Bush's request to control prices during the Mideast crisis. American Airlines has become the latest U.S. air carrier to announce a fare increase because of fuel costs. American says their price hike is connected to higher oil prices brought about by Iraq's invasion of Kuwait.
Fort Worth-based American says the 10% hike in both domestic and overseas ticket prices is necessary because of the rapidly rising cost of fuel. American spokesman Ed Stewart says the airline faces an additional $720 million in fuel costs because of rising prices, and that increase will be quickly felt by the airline.
We have only a two-and-a-half-day supply of fuel here, so it's not like we can buy fuel at a lower price and store it in advance. We're forced to buy it at the most expensive rate.
American's action is particularly significant because it is the largest U.S. airline, and other major air carriers are considered likely to follow. Two other airlines, Pan Am and Northwest, have already raised their ticket prices because of fuel costs. Stewart says the higher fares will go into effect Friday. However, current ticket holders will be unaffected. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Allen in Dallas.
Sources in the West African country of Gambia say that a five-nation peacekeeping force will be ready to intervene in Liberia's civil war within 10 days. The force, to be led by a veteran general from Ghana, will be composed of more than 2,500 soldiers. West African leaders decided yesterday to send in the force to impose a ceasefire, restore law and order, and establish an interim government. Neither President Samuel Doe nor the leaders of the two Liberian rebel factions will be part of the proposed interim government, which is to organize elections within 12 months. The stock market made a comeback today, boosted by a slight retreat in oil prices. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 24 points to close at 2,734.9. Declines led advances by 2-to-1 in heavy trading of 190 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Andrew Sarris, has been writing about movies for 35 years. For almost 30 years, he wrote for The Village Voice. Some people regard him as the dean of American film critics. In 1962, Sarris became the first American film critic to write about the auteur theory. The idea was that the director of a movie was the person most responsible for it, and that movies could be better understood if they were seen in the context of a director's complete body of work. Pauline Kael wrote a spirited critique of Sarris in 1963, and as another film critic observed, Kael and Sarris's wrangle over the auteur theory had the excitement of politics and sport. The intensity of their debate lured people to see new films and to see old movies in a new way. Sarris is now the film critic for the New York Observer and a professor of film at Columbia University. Andrew Sarris first began writing about movies in the mid-50s, when there was less film criticism than there is today.
there weren't as many varieties of it, and it was rather conventional, and it was rather official. That is to say, you know, there were serious movies and there were not so serious movies, and the prevailing attitude of serious people was that movies were, particularly Hollywood movies, were not very important or not worth spending too much time about. They were a little silly. They weren't as profound as the theater or literature. And there were very few people who, made film a kind of religion, you know, taking it very seriously. That is compared to today, where film is taken very seriously, perhaps more seriously than almost anything else.
What made you start to take film very seriously?
Well, I always loved film. I had a, guilty, intellectual attitude toward it. I loved it, but I was a little ashamed of it. And then I stopped being ashamed of it, and I realized that many of the things I liked were really very profound. And I think the year in Paris I spent in 61 sort of changed my life in that respect. I began to read very brilliant people who were writing about film, and I thought, if these people took film seriously, that's the least I could do. And also, I began to take American films more seriously because I began to understand genres and subtexts and myths and legends whereas previously the dominant strain of film criticism was sociological, and is it important and how does it contribute to the class struggle or the struggle of the poor against the rich and so forth. It was very political and dealt with problems, so to speak. And these were the kinds of subjects that the new critics in Europe, in various cities, various places, it's all around the world. This was after the war. Right after the war, in the 40s, the world was a very serious place. We had to defeat fascism and so on. But after the war, suddenly a new generation of people came up who were not so caught up in all the battles of the 30s and the 40s, and these people began to develop new attitudes toward film. And I got caught up in that, and film became very important in my life.
Do you think that you took your cues in a way from the French critics?
Well, in the beginning, they were much more serious about film than we were, and they dealt with ideas, and I like to deal with ideas. The ideas that films generate are what is important to me. And the French, they're ideological to a fault. They find ideas out of everything. There's also something else that I liked about the French, French culture as opposed to, let's say, Germanic culture. And that is, it doesn't make these false distinctions. The kitsch, is a German word. It isn't a French word. The French, and it's also something tied up with Christianity, too, with a religious attitude, that no sparrow falls that isn't noticed, and no subject is unimportant. That is to say that there are no such thing as intellectuals, subjects, and non-intellectual subjects. There are intellectuals and there are non-intellectuals. And for an intellectual, every subject is worthy of thought and discussion.
You wrote a now-famous article in 1962 about the auteur theory of film. And you became the leading American exponent of the auteur theory. Explain what you meant back in 1962.
Well, many people have complained, with some justification, that it wasn't a theory at all. It was something called the politique des auteurs, which Truffaut had coined in 1954 in the Cahiers du Cinéma. And it was more a policy. It was that certain directors, you studied their works as a body, and the ones that interested you, that their work was always more interesting than the work of people. And this is true of all the other arts, but nobody had ever applied it quite so rigorously to film. Some people say, I claim that I invented the idea of the director as a dominant artist in film, and that's not true, because film history, if you go way back to people like Graham Greene and Dwight MacDonald and John Grierson in the 30s, they always organized their studies of film. They always discussed it in terms of individual directors. So there was nothing new about that. What was new was that I took a great many American action directors, genre directors, much more seriously than they had been taken in the past. And that was the big debate I had with Pauline Kael over that at that time. Since then, of course, everything has sort of gone topsy-turvy. I mean, she's now more addicted to that even than I am. But at that time, that was it. And to me, I thought, you know, there was a lovely film directed by Max O'Fools called One Woman's Story. And when Bosley Crowther reviewed it, he didn't even mention the director's name in the review. And that would be unthinkable today, that you wouldn't mention the name of the director of anything. But my idea is this, that the act of directing a movie is different than, say, the act of directing a play, because I believe in a dramatist theater. I'm not very enchanted with the new director's kind of theater, although I think some directors have been very creative. But basically, I believe that plays exist, are basically the dominant artist in the theater is the dramatist, person who writes the text. In the movies, however, it is not so much the script, it's what happens on the set. The film is something different than the script from which it's written.
When you started to think about movies in terms of the auteur and in terms of the director as the auteur, what kind of different reading did you come up with than mainstream film criticism had? For instance, what were some of the recognized masterpieces of the theory of the cinema at the time that you didn't think were that good, and what were some of your alternative choices?
Well, in 1960, for example, I thought one of the great films of the year was Psycho, the Alfred Hitchcock movie, and very few critics would, you know, list that as one of the best movies of the year, although that many of them liked it, but they didn't think it would be important enough. It certainly wasn't important as an Ingmar Bergman movie, for example. And I felt it was just as important, and in many cases better than many of the Ingmar Bergman movies. Mainstream criticism, if you came up with a film that had a serious subject, the war, or poor people, or the Grapes of Wrath, or something like that, not that there's anything wrong with the Grapes of Wrath, but the Grapes of Wrath isn't any greater than other John Ford films that are not about poor people and their problems.
Film critic Andrew Sarris is my guest. When you started writing about genre films, about Westerns and crime movies, what got you to take them seriously?
Well, I always liked them, and then I decided that was the great genius of the Hollywood system, that it wasn't a realistic art form. It was a mythological art form, and particularly the film noir. I once said, you know, that only a good film teaches you how to live, but even a bad movie can teach you how to die. And the dark films, I thought, particularly in Hollywood, had long been underrated. I think, for example, now, I think some of the most interesting films being made today are in the horror genre. I think a film like The Fly, the new version, is much more interesting than something like Terms of Endearment. It's through sometimes very disreputable genres, and I must confess, it took me a long time to get into the horror genre. I didn't get into that. It was a friend of mine who sort of dragged me screaming into it. But now that I've gotten into it, I find, you know, something like Arachnophobia, I find it much more interesting than a lot of so-called humanistic films.
But you've written recently that you think things have swung in the opposite direction, that now genre films are taken so seriously, and yet a lot of the genre films being turned out now are big budget bores.
Yeah, I think that the problem, even something with sort of an interesting idea like Total Recall, which is based on an interesting idea, that sense of consciousness, the trouble with it is it's all bang, bang, bang. It's all one shock after another until finally it's just exhausting. It's just so much, and there's no build-up, and there's no suggestion, there's no development. There's no time even for anything to develop, and it has a terrible ending and all that. What was interesting about, you know, some of the things in the 40s, like the things that Agee discovered and Farber and other critics of that time, the B pictures, the glories of the B pictures, is that they developed very interesting characters and interesting atmosphere and little touches of realism in these, you know, neglected movies, movies that nobody took very seriously. It was the big productions were just sort of completely glossy and phony and empty. And similarly today, I'm not one of those people who say that every movie that costs a lot of money is bad and every movie that, you know, you make in a garage is great. There is something to be said for production values on any level, but there is a tendency now to overproduce, to concentrate. I noticed now particularly one of the things that's changed since all the years that I've never seen credit lists at the end of a movie so long as they are now. They go on for about 10 minutes. I mean, and there are thousands of people. I mean, I wonder how is anybody unemployed in the United States when I see about 300 names after every dinky special effects extravaganza.
You and me must be the only ones staying to watch the names, though.
Everybody's long gone, out of
exactly
the theater,
right,
into the street. We're still waiting there. Although we may be listening to the end of the 37th rock tune that they're playing, too. I don't know.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is film critic Andrew Saras. This is Fresh Air. Andrew Saras is my guest. He's been called the Dean of American Film Criticism. For many years, he wrote about film for the Village Voice. He's now the film critic for the New York Observer, and he's a professor of film at Columbia University. You're really one of the few people I know who has been both a journalist and an academic simultaneously. Do you feel like you've existed in the middle of two worlds?
Yeah, well, that's a line I use in that one article I wrote in Film Comment. I said I've always been too much of a journalist for the academics and too much of an academic for the journalist, so I get caught in between. Yeah, I don't say that film is it supplants anything else. I mean, I tell my students very often, some people, you know, they think they can look at a film 25 times and then they'll understand it. I say, no, you don't. You look at it once and then go and read about 10 books and look at 20 paintings and listen to some music and study the world around you and have a life, get a relationship, so on, and then go back to the movie, and you'll have some new insights into it. It's not what you get out of movies so much, it's what you put into them. And the justification for my life, for my career, are all the very brilliant people on several continents, London, Paris, New York, and many other cities around the world, who have thought seriously about film and have contributed to film scholarship and have made it a very serious area of study. And so one thing I want to do at Columbia is make film one of the humanities.
My guest is film critic Andrew Saras. You were very sick for a few years, I believe it was. Can I ask you to describe your condition, what you had?
Yeah, well, my wife has written a book called Molly Haskell, Love and Other Infectious Diseases, and it's about the illness and her reaction to it and how we survived. Well, she had her share of troubles. In the 80s, she had 5 operations. I had 3, and one of mine was very serious. I had something called cytomegalovirus, CMV, which is an opportunistic virus, and a lot of people thought that it was connected with AIDS. I was questioned about it. It wasn't in my case, and it was something of a mystery because it took a long time for anybody to find out. But I was very sick, and I went crazy for a while. And I remember my hallucinations and all that. And it was a harrowing period. And now that it's over, it's interesting to think back on it a little bit. But you know what Nietzsche said, anything that doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So I guess that was it. But that was it. That was what I had. And I was out for about 7 months, and I came back.
You said that one of the symptoms was going crazy for a while, and your wife in her book says one of the symptoms was paranoia. I was wondering, looking back, how you experienced the paranoia at the time and how you remember it now.
Well, when people, and my wife's mother said that, my mother-in-law said, told people that I'm paranoid. He said, but he was always paranoid. You know, in our field, it's paranoia is more or less. I mean, New York is the home of paranoia. And I was always paranoid. And in fact, I was more paranoid then than I am now. I think the illness sort of got rid of that paranoia, or else I'm not as paranoid about many things as I used to be. Also, people behave very beautifully. And but I had incredible. I used to think that my mother, that Molly, it's a nice slip there, Freudian slip, that Molly was running around with Frank Sinatra, and Greta Garbo was writing me, and I had all kinds of hallucinations, and that people were trying to kill me, and that Molly was against me, and it was fascinating. In other words, I was technically crazy. That is, you know, if I had a gun, I would have killed somebody. And one thing I found about that period, about being crazy, is that it's so boring to be crazy. It's so silly, so stupid. And this is why I'm so very much an Aristotelian. I'm tired of hearing about crazy people. I'm tired of reading about crazy people. I don't find them interesting. I think craziness is, well, we have certainly too much of it today. It's all over the world. So many people are crazy, and people are doing crazy things. And I think it's a problem, but I think it's a rather boring problem as far as there's nothing to be said about it. That period where I was crazy, it was completely useless. I was useless to anybody. I was a minus to the world.
Did you watch movies when you were sick?
Yeah, I watched them in a very peculiar way. Actually, at times I was so sick, I suddenly realized that I was, when you can get so sick and so tired, so exhausted from illness and pain, that it's too exhausting even to look at television, you realize it takes a certain amount of psychic energy even to look at movies or television. But I used to look at things on television, because, you know, I didn't look at movies when I was lying there, but I looked at television, and I used to hallucinate what I was looking at. I used to look at baseball games, and suddenly there would be, you know, characters from Sesame Street, you know, would be stepping up to the plate. You know, it was, you know, there were weird things were happening in my mind.
You came close to death when you were sick.
Yeah, and as some doctor said, I was the sickest person ever to walk out of New York Hospital.
I'm reminded of something you said a little earlier. You said even a bad movie can teach you how to die. I forget what you were, if you were quoting yourself or somebody else, but I was wondering if that's the kind of thing you were thinking about when you were really ill.
No, actually, I decided one thing. I decided that the mind is wonderful in one way. It's, you know, about pain and suffering, the mind, you know, you develop these delusions. I think my craziness helped me survive, because if I had been completely lucid and understood everything that was happening, I think, and knowing how people were terrified about what was happening and how sick I really was, I probably would have died. I would have been so frightened, so depressed, and so forth. But by developing all these hatreds and violence in my mind, it enabled me to fight. I had imaginary enemies to fight, and that kept me going.
Film critic Andrew Sarris is my guest. You and your wife, Molly Haskell, are both film critics.
Yeah.
And I wonder what the rules of the house are about discussing movies before you've written about them. If you're worried about influencing each other's opinions. And you know that sometimes...
Well, there was only one brief period in our lives when we had that problem. I was reviewing for The Voice, and Molly was first string critic for New York Magazine. And we were going to the same screenings, and we couldn't talk to each other, and we couldn't use each other's insights. It was very difficult for us because one of the things that got us together, we're a very strange couple in that this respect. We're both doing the same thing. There aren't many married people that are doing exactly the same thing. But Molly comes from a different vantage point. She's become very much a feminist film critic, and she's dealt in that thing. But the problem with us, the reason that we haven't started a Siskel Ebert thing, you know, is that, you know, you know, if I could come on as a male chauvinist pig, you know, and Molly as a, you know, a feminist bitch, you know, and that we'd screech at each other, you know, that would be very good television. But we are disgustingly in agreement. People say, oh, you're in agreement because you're married. And say, no, we got married because we were in agreement, because we do have the same sensibility.
I imagine that a lot of our listeners have video cassette recorders, and video has given us access to film history in a way that we've never really had it before.
That's true.
So let me ask you to name a few of your favorite films, and you could go as far into the past as you want to, films that you might want to recommend to us to see if we haven't already seen them.
Yeah, well, I'd like to recommend, my favorite film of all time is probably Madame Deux, the Max O'Fools film with Daniel Derrière. It's a French film with subtitles. Although I'm on record as saying Lola Montez is the greatest film of all time, but that was some time ago, but I don't agree entirely there, although I still admire it very much. And there's a laser disc where I do a commentary on it. Also, Getsu, the Japanese film, and I don't know, the Mitsuguchi film, and La Règle du Jeu, the Jean Renoir. Those have been for many years my three great films. Among American films, films I admire as Orson Welles' Magnificent Ambersons, Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, John Ford's The Searchers, The Great Dictator to Modern Times by Chaplin, Buster Keaton's Steamboat Bill Jr., particularly Sherlock Jr., and Buñuel's Belle du Jour, Red River, Leone's Once Upon a Time in the West, hundreds. I'm not much on, you know, desert island. You know, if you were going to a desert island, what 10 pictures would you take? I would never go to a desert island, and I would never take just 10 movies. I think I'd just get sick of them. I have to have hundreds of movies and keep seeing new things all the time and changing them. Also, one of the things that I find that I get frustrated sometimes, and people sometimes don't fully appreciate about movies, is that there are so many bad movies.
Yes.
And you have to have some feeling about how bad a movie can be
before you can
appreciate why people are so like the good ones.
Well, Andrew Saras, I thank you very much for talking with us about movies and about your life. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Andrew Saras is film critic for the New York Observer and professor of film at Columbia University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Middle East specialist Lenore Martin puts the Persian Gulf crisis in a cultural and historical context. Martin is a fellow at Harvard Center for Mideast Studies. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Giancarlo Esposito was acting with the Negro Ensemble Company in 1980 when he met a film school graduate named Spike Lee. Coming up, Esposito talks about his roles in Lee's movies Do the Right Thing, School Days, and Mo' Better Blues. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says the recent renaissance of the Broadway musical has led to a spate of reissues of Broadway music. Lloyd has a review of a reissue of Mary Martin singing the music of Richard Rodgers, with Rodgers himself sitting in on piano. And critic Maureen Corrigan wonders why we can't leave Lucy and Desi alone. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush said today that the U.S. is not at war in the Middle East and that U.S. troops were sent for defensive reasons and for the protection of American life. The president spoke to reporters this afternoon, a few hours after informing the American public that U.S. troops and warplanes have been sent to Saudi Arabia. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The president said the main purpose of the action was to defend Saudi Arabia and not to drive Iraq out of Kuwait. Mr. Bush said he hoped the economic sanctions voted by the UN would take care of that. The president said the U.S. was not alone in sending military forces to defend the Saudi kingdom.
I believe Margaret Thatcher, after talking to King Fahd, has announced that forces will be going in, and then I think you'll see other such actions, but I'd much prefer to leave that to Saudi Arabia, who indeed it's their country.
Mr. Bush said he did not want to heighten tensions in the Gulf, but said he considers the protection of American life fundamental to his job and responsibilities. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
As the president indicated today, Britain has decided to send forces to Saudi Arabia after an emergency meeting of the British cabinet. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from London.
The British will be sending air and additional naval forces to supplement four British warships in or near the Persian Gulf. But there will be no British ground forces, and the British contingent will be entirely defensive. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher joined the U.S. deployment after some personal persuasion in a telephone call yesterday from President Bush and a call from the Saudi ruler King Fahd requesting help. There are as yet no details available about what specific forces will be sent and how soon they will arrive. But the British have several fighter squadrons stationed at a base in Cyprus, only a few hundred miles from Iraq, and they could be readied quickly. The British may not station all their forces in Saudi Arabia itself. They may be based in other Gulf states, such as Oman or the United Arab Emirates, where the British have deep ties. NATO holds an emergency foreign ministers meeting on Friday in Brussels, where the U.S. and Great Britain are expected to argue for wider European cooperation in the Saudi operation. I'm Mike Schuster in London.
American Airlines, the nation's largest air carrier, has announced across-the-board fare increases of 10% because of what it called a rapidly rising cost of jet fuel. American said its fares in the U.S. will go up Friday, while international fares will be raised August 15th. The Atlantic Richfield Company has announced that it's freezing wholesale fuel prices for 1 week and encouraging its dealers not to increase prices at the pump. Earlier, the president called on oil companies to do their fair share in holding down gasoline prices. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 24 points to close at 2,734.90. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on in the show, I'll talk with actor Giancarlo Esposito. He plays jazz pianist Left Hand Lacy in Spike Lee's new movie, Mo' Better Blues. But first, a different kind of music.
One, two, there's a small hotel with a wishing well. I wish that we were there together. There's a bridal suite, one room bright and neat, complete for us to share together.
That's Mary Martin singing the Rodgers and Hart song, There's a Small Hotel. In 1957, Martin and composer Richard Rodgers got together for a recording session. The album Mary Martin sings, Richard Rodgers plays, has long been a theater buff's collector's item. RCA has just reissued it on compact disc. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
The Broadway musical has been in something of a renaissance. I don't mean particularly on Broadway itself, but on recordings. Great old scores are being revived with their delightful and stylish original orchestrations. My one disappointment has been with the singers, most of whom seem awfully bland compared to the lively personalities of the great stars for whom the songs were first written. One of the greatest of them is Mary Martin, the wide-eyed girl from Weatherford, Texas, who floored Broadway in 1938 by innocently singing Cole Porter's My Heart Belongs to Daddy, wearing a fur jacket and nothing else. But after Rodgers and Hammerstein's South Pacific, her image was fixed as the clean-cut girl next door. Boy next door, if you count Peter Pan. Or nun next door, if you count her biggest hit, Rodgers and Hammerstein's The Sound of Music. She was always charming, but her material became awfully sanitized. When Mary Martin and Richard Rodgers got together in 1957 for a recording session of Rodgers' tunes, they chose only songs that had not been written for her, like Some Enchanted Evening, the big song in South Pacific she never got to sing. In fact, most of the songs they recorded are by Rodgers and his earlier and greater partner, Lorenz Hart. It's good to have Mary Martin singing lyrics that call for some of the slyness and wryness that first made her a star. Here she is singing Rodgers and Hart's Wicked to Keep My Love Alive, which they wrote for the revival of a Connecticut Yankee in 1943. It was Hart's last lyric. He died a week after the show opened.
I married many men, a ton of them, because I was untrue to none of them. Because I bumped off every one of them to keep my love alive. Sir Paul was frail, he looked a wreck to me. At night he was a horse's neck to me. So I performed an appendectomy to keep my love alive. Sir Thomas had insomnia. He couldn't sleep at night. I bought a little arsenic. He's sleeping now all right. Sir Philip played the...
Mary Martin never sounded like anyone else. She obviously has a trained voice, but its humanizing flaws, the occasional little creak or croak, make it instantly recognizable. Her diction is flawless, sometimes even a little too manicured, but she never preens. A few weeks ago, I heard a Broadway evening at the Boston Pops, and the singing cipher who did Night and Day was so full of himself, a friend of mine remarked that he should have changed the words to Night and Day, I am the one. Mary Martin gives herself to the song. Her phrasing makes you believe she knows the implications of every word. Here she is really living one of the best Broadway songs ever written, Rodgers and Hart's It Never Entered My Mind, from their 1940 musical Higher and Higher.
Once I laughed when I heard you say that I'd be playing solitaire, uneasy in my It never entered my mind. Once you told me I was mistaken, that I'd awaken with the sun, and order orange juice for one. It never entered my mind. And now I even have to scratch my back myself.
This album includes some fascinating rarities, like Moon of My Delight from Chi Chi, a show, So Help Me, about a man who doesn't want to become a eunuch. It was Rodgers and Hart's biggest flop. The orchestrations on this album by Robert Russell Bennett are all rather on the syrupy side. Some of the verses are even in the wrong place. And yet the recording was made with the composer himself at the piano. So much for authenticity. Richard Rodgers was clearly not one of the keyboard geniuses of the Great White Way, but his brief and clunky accompaniments for a performer so close to his heart make a touching souvenir.
Lloyd Schwartz reviewed Mary Martin Sings, Richard Rodgers Plays on RCA. This is Fresh Air. Giancarlo Esposito is probably best known for his role as Buggin' Out in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. Buggin' Out was the volatile character who demanded that Sal, the Italian owner of the Brooklyn Pizzeria, put pictures of black heroes on the wall.
Mookie, you want to get your friend out of here?
What, are you going to kick me out now? Are you going to kick me out, huh?
No, I'm not kicking you out. You're kicking yourself out.
What? Look, we got some brothers up on the wall, you know? Malcolm X, Nelson Mandela, you know, Michael Jordan. Tomorrow.
Come on, Mookie, get him out, all right?
I'm trying to get him out.
I paid for it.
I know you paid for it. Let's go. Yeah, all right. So you're kicking me out. Beat me in the head and kick me out, right?
Come on, let's
yeah,
go.
Okay, bet. Yeah, all right. Let's yeah, go. Look, I paid for my. Look, boycott Sal.
Go.
Right?
Yo,
boycott Sal.
I got your boycott swinging. Boycott.
Esposito met Spike Lee in 1980. Lee was just out of film school, and Esposito was starring in the Negro Ensemble Company's production of Zuman and the Sign. Lee gave Esposito a starring role in the 1988 film School Days as fraternity leader Big Brother Almighty. In Lee's new film, Mo' Better Blues, Esposito plays Left Hand Lacey, the pianist in the jazz quintet led by a trumpeter played by Denzel Washington. I'll let Esposito describe his character.
Left Hand Lacey is a guy who is a wonderful pianist, and he's gone to Europe with the group and met a French woman, and he takes a lot of flack in the film and also while making the film from having this this woman, Jeanne, who is, of course, he's very much in love with, around all the time, and she sort of controls his life. I really sort of fashioned him as a cross between Lester Young and also Thelonious Monk. I just felt that he had the kind of energy that no one else in the group had, and that he was a little bit out there, and he really didn't care about the feuding that was going on within the group and who was playing what music and whose music would be played. He was just totally in love with his music, with playing the piano. So I kind of put those two guys together and came up with Left Hand Lacey.
You said not only did the character take heat in the movie, but you took heat while making the movie. What did you get the heat for?
Well, you know, working on a Spike Lee film was very different, and people really get into their work, and they really become their characters. And I also happened to have a woman in my life who is not black, who is white. And so that kind of thing comes up. You know, people sort of take their roles all the way down the road. And so I got a little ribbing for that, and I think that was just to help people relate to me on screen in the same manner. So it wasn't any kind of serious heat, it was just all character heat.
In Do the Right Thing, you played Buggin' Out, and that's the character who wants Sal, the Danny Aiello character, to put pictures of blacks on his pizzeria's wall of fame. How did you see the character? Did you see the character as a flake or someone with a strong political point he was trying to make?
Interesting you asked that. I remember the first days of rehearsal, and I really, really loved that character. I've often described him as a guy who has never really read a lot about black history or read a lot about our black political leaders, namely Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. And he opens a book one day and reads a very significant paragraph that tells him
that he needs to sort of make a change within his community and stand up for black pride and black rights. And he takes that, and that's all he has is this one paragraph. And he feels that that's going to be his key to a whole new life, to a whole new world, to changing his whole community. But he doesn't really know the specifics about, nonviolence. He doesn't know how to implement it within his community. He just wants to be someone who he's not yet.
I want to ask you about that confrontation scene in the pizzeria where you as Bugging Out and Bill Nunn as Radio Raheem come into the pizzeria after closing time, and Radio Raheem has Fight the Power blasting on his boombox, and you're demanding everybody boycott the pizzeria. And then Sal takes a baseball bat after you all have words with each other and kills the boombox, you know, by
yeah, that
beating
was...
it with the bat. The way you guys played the scene was not what was written in the script, right?
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, tell me how that evolved.
Well, you know, there was a certain amount of tension on the film, and halfway through making Do the Right Thing, we all knew something was going to happen that with the movie, not particularly on the set. And it was a difficult time because I felt very alone. I, of course, had only one scene with Radio Raheem before that moment. And that scene was a scene in which we had to bond and sort of join forces. No one would talk to him because he was so big and mean-looking in the neighborhood. So, and for me at that time, my only real friend, I would say, on the set was Danny Aiello, which was an odd choice because he's the guy who owns the pizzeria. He is Sal. So for me, that moment became different because we were all getting to the height of the film. And I knew that I had to sort of divorce myself from Danny off screen. And that scene involved really basically myself and Bill. Bill just had to hold the radio and I had most of the lines, and we knew something was going to happen, and we knew that Spike liked ad-libbing. But it was so real is what really happened. I think all of us got caught up in the moment. And it was, you know, a very chilling moment for me in my acting career after 26 years of acting that, you know, you could walk into a room and we were all so involved with our characters that something happened, something just exploded. And I think what it was for me, I know that, you know, all of the anger against the racism that I've encountered in my life sort of came up. It's a very dangerous moment. I think that I always sort of remembered it as Danny just losing it and, yelling, screaming a racial epithet at me, but I was the one, I think, who lost it first in seeing the film or seeing the dailies or the rushes from the movie. I know that we started calling each other names. And I know for me what happened was a real boiling up of something deep within my belly, and it was an anger and it was a hurt, it was a pain that was so immense for me that I was right in the right place. And of course, we lost all of our lines because that's what happens when you get angry. You sort of don't know, you know, what's coming out of your mouth, but you know that you just want to kill the guy who you're having an argument with. And that's sort of the feeling that happened. I remember just going on and on and on, Spike letting the camera roll, and Danny was just turned red, and we were all very, very excited and very angry at each other. And it after the scene, in fact, Danny came around the counter and we just hugged for, oh gosh, at least 3 or 4 minutes.
Well, when you started using ethnic slurs and racial epithets at each other, was there ever any confusion that this might be actually personal, actually be the way you felt about each other?
There really was. There really was. I remember when Danny called me a nigger, I just, you know, Danny reminded me of my dad. My father's Italian, and he's from Naples, Italy. And he never called me a nigger, but he reminded me a lot of my father. Very, very Italian, speaks Italian, just has that whole way about him that's very charismatic and very wonderful. And that's what I like so much about Danny. And that moment when he called me a nigger, I knew that this is what went through my mind. I knew that he had called someone a nigger before. And I knew that it wasn't necessarily on a film set. And it was frightening to me. And I'm sure he felt the same way about the things that I was calling him. And that's when I knew that we were both sort of, you know, exercising some horrible demon.
Are you and Danny Aiello still friends?
Yes, we are. Yeah, I really admire him, and I really dig him. He's a great guy to talk to. And in fact, I saw him last week at the film, the little film thing at the Gracie Mansion, in which Robert De Niro got an award. So, of course, Danny was there, and we hugged and talked, and he's just a great guy. Yeah.
With a name like Giancarlo Esposito, did you ever show up at an audition and have the casting director expect you to be a white Italian?
Yes, that has happened. It's very interesting. And I can't remember for what, but I know a number of years ago it happened quite often. Lately, it hasn't happened too much because I used to go to open calls, you know, for different jobs, and that's when it usually happens. And I like to go to auditions where there is no racial connotation to the character that's being auditioned. I feel like that's where I have a lot of strength, because I feel as if today in casting they need to change things and be a little more liberal about the way they cast movies.
Did you grow up in the States or did you grow up in Italy?
I grew up, well, I often say in Italy. I went back very recently with my dad over to Naples, and my father and mother were divorced after 11 years of marriage, so I found out that I thought I was there till five, but my father sort of straightened me out. I said, no, you left Italy when you were about three. So I lived in Italy until 3 years old and came to New York and then moved to Cleveland, Ohio, which is where I spent quite a bit of time, and then moved back up to New York, up to the suburbs in Westchester County.
Now, your resume says that you started acting at around age six. Whose idea was it to start that young, yours or one of your parents?
It was actually myself and my brother were sitting around one Saturday morning watching Gigantor on TV. And my mom and dad were going through a divorce, and so it was a difficult time. And she was doing eight shows a week or more at Radio City Music Hall to try to pay the rent. And I remember just sitting around going, well, you know, we were watching this commercial. My brother and I said, why can't we do that? And we literally said, hey, you know, Mommy, we wanted to help her out, and why can't we do commercials and help pay the mortgage on the house? And she took us down to an agent, and the agent sort of said, hey, these boys have talent. And 2 days later, we were off auditioning for a Broadway show, Maggie Flynn, and we both got in. So that's how it started. It was really my decision, and I thought it would be fun. And that's really the reason why I got involved. That's the only reason. I remember, you know, having to take a lot of lessons, which I didn't like, and not being able to play, and studying the piano, studying music, studying drama. So it wasn't as much fun as I thought it would be until now, until later on. Because acting is a very difficult profession, especially when you don't have a name and you're not, you know, considered to be a big star. But I fell in love with it, and that's what happened to me.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
I want to thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Giancarlo Esposito plays Left Hand Lacey in Spike Lee's new movie, Mo' Better Blues. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have on American forces beginning to arrive in the Middle East?
Hi, Terry. President Bush made a speech this morning to justify that U.S. troop deployment in Saudi Arabia and to warn Iraq's Saddam Hussein not to use chemical weapons. NPR's Neil Conan will review that issue of chemical weapons and would Iraq dare to use them and how they might be delivered and what the U.S. response might be. Also, Ted Clark analyzes the efficacy of a trade embargo against Iraq. The American Bar Association meeting in Chicago votes to overturn its previous position in favor of abortion rights. And Linda Wertheimer has a conversation with Benazir Bhutto, now deposed as Pakistan's leader.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last Monday was Lucille Ball's birthday. She would have been 79. Ever since the world's favorite redhead died last year, we've been bombarded with I Love Lucy dolls, plates, video collections, even Lucy and Ricky impersonators. But commentator Maureen Corrigan says it'll take more than red hair and a way with conga drums to recreate the magic of the real Lucy and Ricky.
Wah! Why won't they let Lucy rest in peace? When CBS exhumed two lost episodes of I Love Lucy, I thought for sure that there was no new Lucy material left for anyone to cash in on. Right. Some producer at CBS has had the bright idea of making a made-for-TV movie about Lucy and Desi's early years. It's called Lucy and Desi Before the Laughter. As Ricky Ricardo would say, somebody's got some splainin' to do. Made-for-TV movies about dead celebrities are always awful. Every time I watch one, I'm conscious of how the actors are straining to look and sound like Liberace or Karen Carpenter. CBS wants unknowns to play the Lucy Desi parts. Last week's People magazine had a photo spread of some hopefuls lined up for auditions. There were Lucys in hair bows and pearls, African-American and senior citizen Lucys, and bug-eyed Rickys itching to sing Baba Lou. They were all trying so hard to look madcap. It's enough to make you reach for a good stiff shot of Vitamita Vegemin. What the media moguls don't realize is that I Love Lucy is nearly perfect, just as it is. The fact that we only see the show now in reruns has even enhanced its power. We're experiencing the series the way James Joyce wanted readers to experience his masterwork, Ulysses. Joyce said that he expected readers to constantly reread Ulysses until all the episodes of the novel would appear to them simultaneously, in one unified moment. He wanted to give readers a sense of mythic rather than linear time. Well, despite Joyce's hopes, few readers work that hard. But those of us who've watched Lucy over and over have experienced that circularity of reference that Joyce was after. Here's a typical Lucy moment.
How does oven door get open?
You hear echoes in that frantic cry of every scrape Lucy ever got into, baking a giant loaf of bread, hatching chickens in the living room, and always scheming to perform in Ricky's show. In last year's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Mambo Kings Sing Songs of Love, Oscar Huelos captured this power of the Lucy reruns to suspend time. One character, Eugenio, watches faithfully for the episode in which his dead father makes a guest appearance. Eugenio says, "For me, my father's gentle rapping on Ricky Ricardo's door has always been a call from the beyond. I feel the same way whenever I hear the I Love Lucy theme. It's a call from a realm beyond death and change. I wish people would quit tampering with that illusion. Like Ricky has told Lucy about a million times, just stay away from the show."
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produce the interviews on Fresh Air, with research assistance from Dan Buskirk and Lisa McCullough. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Middle East specialist Lenore Martin discusses the crisis in the Persian Gulf from a historical, cultural, and religious perspective. Also, we meet Richard Adler. He co-wrote the scores for the musicals Damn Yankees and The Pajama Game. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.